Welcome to part two of my discussion with Ilya Shapiro. Ilya is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute, and we'll continue our discussion about some of the most important issues facing society and its relationship to law today. It's a complex topic, but I think the common theme to me is that we live in a free society, okay? And I think we have to be very, very cautious, extremely cautious, about overriding individual freedom for any reason, or we don't live in a free society. And that leads me into sort of what I would like to go into is this issue of freedom, and particularly, you know, free speech. This is a very fundamental.
Before we get to that, and of course that I've spent an increasing amount of my time on free speech and problems in higher ed and otherwise. But I want to make one point to close the pandemic topic, and that's kind of abuse by bureaucrats and all that. And that's that not all solution. I have enough professional humility to recognize that not all solution, not all problems have a legal solution. The law only goes so far. At a certain point, it's politics, it's education, it's communication, it's psychology, and all of these different things. So it's not simply a matter of why wasn't the right lawsuit filed? Can it be filed now? Do we need a new law? Yeah, you can make tweaks around the margin. You can do certain things, and in general, there were plenty of lawyers willing to file, and with some success. You know, Navy SEALs resisting vax mandate, like lots of different things. That again, I don't want to rehash the COVID example, but it's not purely a legal problem. It's
I completely agree. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. It's more fundamental than that. It's more about really, I think, in a bigger sense, being a free society. It's more about individuals speaking up. It's more about, you know, what kind of ethical or moral scale and construct you have. And it's a very complicated topic.
And it's about group dynamics. Once one judge in Florida, happens to be an acquaintance of mine, blocked masking on airplanes, the government didn't even resist at that point. And everybody was like, oh, of course. Okay, great. We don't have to wear masks anymore. And up until it had to do something like that. Otherwise, maybe we'd still be masking at this point. It's just bizarre. There's no logical conclusion. And I remember also one time I was outside with my sons, who are now 8 and 6. I guess at the time they were 5 and 3 or something. But they were playing soccer. And I think I was the only parent on the sideline outdoors who wasn't masked. And nobody was giving me the stink eye, by the way. This is in Northern Virginia. So people were not, they're just kind of like, you know, the next week, every week at the soccer practice, soccer game, more and more parents would unmask because they saw, oh, it's okay to do so. And just the psychological dynamic of this was was remarkable. And again, it wasn't they were shaming me. How dare you be spreading the virus? I don't think anybody was buying into the point that we're about. It's about virtue signaling, which, you know.
Yeah, complicated topic. All right, let's move into this idea of free speech. And why, you know, this is something that sort of, you know, I was a little kid in the 60s when it sort of was the last time this was such a big deal of protests and everything. But I sort of wonder again, and I ask many people this, because I don't think there's a good understanding by regular people in the public. What is free speech, and what exceeds its limits? And I'm not asking shouting fire in a movie theater. I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. And we see it in disruptions on campuses, even in Congress, in classrooms, you know, who has domain over what defines free speech and in what setting? And this is a big topic, of course, but I'm going to hand it to you.
I wrote an essay in the Free Press, Barry Weiss's publication, back in late October, early November, soon after the October 7th atrocities in Israel. Barry asked me to write like a short op-ed kind of on the limits of free speech, and it just ballooned, ended up being, I think we cut it down, but couldn't get it below 2,500 words. It still holds up. And there's really, you know, it was focused on campus speech, not exclusively, but there's really three buckets. There's things that we've seen, protests, what have you, that aren't speech at all. So blocking a street to get your message out. Well, I don't care if you're being expressive, if you're talking about politics or being artistic, you can't just block streets. There are laws against that. There are neutral laws. Doesn't matter what your viewpoint is, and you'll get it. You don't get out of them just by saying that, well, you're being expressive, or vandalism or assault or any of these criminal laws, just because there's an expressive purpose to it or element to it, that's not a defense. The most colorful example of this is somebody urinated on a Hillel somewhere, a Jewish student organization building, and you know, claimed that, well, I was just expressing my disapproval for that organization's activities. I'm like, well, sorry, there's, you know, you can express that in various ways. You can write a letter to the editor, you can hold up a sign, you know, all, you know, but urination, public urination, is still an equally applicable crime. So that's the non-speech things, or blocking access to things, you know, blocking the sidewalk, you know, impeding people from getting to work, all these different things, let alone assault and these other things. Okay, then we have speech that's not protected. So in this context, you know, the Supreme Court has talked about true threats. If you're actually threatening somebody with death or bodily injury, there's a high bar for that. The jurisprudence is established, but there's a high bar for that. That's not protected. Or if you're inciting violence, and there's also a high bar for that. So, for example, if you're just having a demonstration somewhere and you're saying all sorts of things that somebody might find offensive, that's okay. It's protected. You know, but there's no hate speech exclusion from the First Amendment, or for most colleges, free expression rules for that matter. But if you go beyond simply being offensive and you're calling for violence, you're saying, and therefore any Jew that you see today, punch them in the face. That is not protected speech. Or if you're directing your actions, your chants towards the only dorm housing Jewish students on campus or something like that, it's a little bit different. We get into rules about harassment, intimidation, things that are, you know, long established at common law that have been codified in both civil and criminal codes. And then we have the third bucket, that's time, place, and manner regulations. So, for example, what is at the core of the First Amendment? Or forget, you know, legalities. What do we think is the most important type of speech to protect? Political speech. You can't have a free society if we can't discuss what our rulers, what the government's doing, criticize it, debate it, etc. Well, still, I can't go into your neighborhood at 2 a.m. and tell you with a bullhorn exactly what I think of Donald Trump and Joe Biden. That's disturbing the peace. And there's nothing wrong with arresting me for doing that. Or similarly, on college campuses, you know, you can have debates of whatever, but not if it disrupts classes, not if it disrupts a speaker that's been invited by a student group that's duly reserved the room, things like that. Not if it disrupts deans from going about their administrative work, professors in their offices, all these, the normal programs of an institution of higher education. And there are parallels in the real world as well. So again, non-speech, exceptions to speech protections, high bar for death threats and incitement of violence, and then time, place, and manner regulation.
But now that brings up several things to my mind, that the laws were not enforced, or at least there was a choice made to not enforce or not even arrest people or not even accuse people of breaking the law. Is that all it was? Now, let's just first talk about the campus stuff. Blocking access to buildings, or even blocking roads. We see this all the time on the news, it seems. people don't seem to necessarily get arrested. Is that just because the choice is made not to arrest them?
Absolutely.
It's not, from what I'm taking it from you is that it's a criminal act. It should be, and they would be found guilty of breaking the law.
It's a misdemeanor, sure.
Yeah, but they're just simply making a decision not to do anything about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
So that's not a valid legal argument.
And it's not, I mean, we've seen different types of enforcement around the country, campus to campus, city to city. Some places let a complete free-for-all, don't enforce any laws. Some start arresting right at the very beginning and don't let any encampments arise or any protesters block streets. And some are somewhere in the middle. They let it go for, you know, a day or two and then start clearing it away. And we see, you know, everybody responds to incentives. If you don't punish, if you don't enforce the rules, then you'll get more rule breaking. There are different, the consequences are different. The practical results are different at the University of Florida, where Ben Sasse, who unfortunately recently had to step down for family reasons, enforced his rules, expelled students, suspended them, had them arrested, cleared out the encampments, and there were no disruptions. Versus Columbia, which was under siege for a long time and apparently is going to be under siege again once classes resume in the fall. Harvard, that reversed its discipline against various students that egregiously violated rules like blocking access, indeed. And you know, and so, what? Once we on educational establishment institutions specifically, once that institution is aware of these things going on and doesn't enforce its rules, then the institution itself can be liable, not just the disruptors and those who violate the criminal laws, but under Title VI, any institution that receives educational funds that doesn't act to allow equal access to educational opportunity is liable. And we've seen lawsuits over that. Some have been settled. The Justice and Education Departments have gotten involved in investigating various schools. So those are very serious things, and still developing area of the law, certainly, but it's not at all the case that we sort of wring our hands and think, oh, if only we had the legal tools to deal with this. Not at all. You put your finger on it. It's a question of the willingness to enforce it. When the Chancellor of Vanderbilt ejected students that had taken over his office, and I think a couple of them who had assaulted campus police were expelled, and he was feted. He became a national hero. I mean, he was doing his job. This is not rocket science. You just have to enforce what's already on the books.
Right. And the lawsuit question that you bring up, when access is blocked, are these lawsuits brought only by individuals who have been harmed? For instance, other students who don't feel safe or can't go to class? Or is this something that can be done, like you say, by breakage of a federal law or even a state law that the government itself can restore what
right.
The correct...
Those are the two paths. So students or others, professors, even visitors potentially, if you're a scheduled speaker and you get blocked, I think you probably... question is, who has standing to sue? This would be a civil suit. That's how that would look. And then the government, the Civil Rights Office of the Department of Education, for example, or the Justice Department can act under those authorities to investigate and eventually prosecute and get changes. You know, at that point, the government's not looking for monetary damage necessarily, although they could fine the universities or withhold certain funds. But they're looking to just change the policies and get a consent decree that the university will enforce these rules in the future.
Right. I just want to finish with the one topic, which is the state of law schools these days. You and I spoke at a seminar recently about the sort of ideology invasion, really, of educational institutions and others. And I'm very worried about law schools specifically because, I don't have to tell you, but from my view as just a regular citizen, you know, I'm very worried about fairness in lawyers, in attorneys, and access in the courts. And also, these are the future judges when we're talking about law schools. And what we see, is a bunch of speakers being... not allowed to speak at some of our most, most respected law schools, for instance. So what kind of a situation are we looking at here? Should we be afraid? Is there a trend to reverse that? And what kind of role models are these law school professors setting by allowing this kind of cancel culture, et cetera? What's going on in our law schools?
Well, it goes beyond cancel culture, unfortunately, and you're right that it's worrying that this is happening at law schools, because other than medical schools, where it's literally matters of life and death, and we're turning out doctors who aren't the very best, it's a whole separate issue. But law schools are creating, you know, lawyers who play a big role in our society, especially as the gatekeepers of our legal and political institutions. And indeed, the problem is this illiberal worldview, this mindset that all of our institutions, all of our law is illegitimate in various ways because it's racist, sexist, the hierarchies were put in and improper means, has to be torn down and rebuilt with different privilege hierarchies or intersectional considerations, and all of this kind of postmodern philosophical critical theory. Critical race theory gets talked about a lot, but it's critical theory more broadly, that our institutions are invalid, and the classical liberal values at the heart of not just higher education, but of our law are invalid as well. Free speech, equal protection of the laws, due process, all of these things are unjust. And if lawyers hold to those illiberal views, then yeah, we end up with a different justice based on your identity, based on your relative level of privilege, whether somebody deems you an oppressor or an oppressed class member, all of these sorts of things. Nasty stuff. So it goes far beyond which speakers can be, are shouted down or allowed on campus. It's more about how we conceive of the rules of the game and whether they should apply neutrally to all, or as these critical theorists posit, that the very idea of having neutral rules that apply equally to all are themselves wrong because they misunderstand the relative standing of people in our society, and your rights and freedoms really should depend on who you are and what group you belong to.
I mean, is this I look at the Supreme Court, for instance, and I'm sort of astonished at some of the things that are said by some of the Supreme Court justices. Now, that may sound like a bizarre, arrogant thing to say, but some of these things seem to be pretty clear, and yet clear to me, and yet we hear these sort of politicized statements come out, or we hear things that are really just modifying law. It basically goes back to what I always understood as this originalism of Justice Scalia. I've read a few books of his in the past, versus this living constitution. It's sort of the extreme of this, where all of a sudden the lawyers themselves in judge positions, or even Supreme Court justices, seem to be advocates for viewpoints rather than really interpreting the law. And maybe I'm just reacting to something as a naive person. Is this worse than it's ever been?
I think it's actually worse than you describe, in the sense that this is not the same old debate between left and right, between, as you put it, originalism, the idea that the meaning of the Constitution is fixed and needs to be interpreted based on, figure out what it meant when it was enacted, versus the idea that these provisions are so vague that they're kind of meant to embody the social mores of the time, and therefore they change and develop and evolve over time. Those are kind of the classic different conceptions, and there's pragmatic considerations among all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have, as I said, that's left-right or traditional left-right. Then you have this illiberal view that the law itself indeed has to bend to power dynamics, to identity dynamics. That's really dangerous. And you see that sometimes, for example, if you contrast in the affirmative action case, Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard, last term, the different dissents, as between Sotomayor and Jackson, you get that flavor. Sotomayor is kind of the more traditional baby boomer, if you will, liberal view that, you know, you remedy race discrimination and, you know, sometimes these preferences are justified. Jackson is much more, you know, not fully, but absorbing these postmodern ideas, not just remedying past discrimination, therefore this is justified, but there are, you know, we have systemic racism and therefore, you know, all of these things. So they're somewhat subtle, but that kind of thinking is infecting even the Supreme Court. For more on all of this, you and your listeners can read my forthcoming book, Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, because it's a very important topic. I'm building on my lived experience, such as it is, of course, at Georgetown, but it goes much deeper. And again, the cancel culture we see, the incidents that we see at Yale or Stanford or wherever, is just the tip of the iceberg that obscures kind of the more systemic problems in these institutions.
And what do you see as happening now? Is there something happening as a backlash to this? Or is this even being discussed at these law schools and in the circles that you are in? I mean, what can we anticipate as citizens over the next decade?
Especially since October 7th. And then the disastrous testimony of the university presidents that December, which led to the resignation of the president of Penn, Liz McGill, president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, also had plagiarism issues. There's been a lot more donor activism, trustee activism, other what I call exogenous shocks from employers, including law firms, judges that have, federal judges are boycotting Yale and Stanford, for example. And now Columbia, until they reform their free speech and anti-Semitic policies. State legislatures with respect to public schools are getting involved in various ways. So we do see the start of pushback. And even a wealthy elite institution like Yale Law School, long considered to be the very best in the country, has graduated presidents and top government officials and what have you. Heather Gerken, the dean of Yale, got the message from all the black eyes that the school was getting, and just within the last few months hired a new senior professor, constitutional professor Keith Whittington, and a new junior professor, former Alito clerk, Garrett West. Now, bit of a tokenism. That's, you know, two on a faculty of I don't know how many dozen. But she's getting the message. That's in part because these deans, these university leaders, are generally not woke radicals or social justice warriors. They're spineless cowards. They're careerist bureaucrats who have learned how to climb the greasy pole by responding to incentives. And Heather Gerken, clearly the dean of Yale, wants to be the president of Yale or of her alma mater, Princeton. And she sees that she had to stop the bleeding from her institution. And that's the way these things are going to be changed. It's not by making rational arguments within the system. It's by shining a light on these practices. You know, it doesn't take very much sometimes. John Saylor, who's an investigative reporter with the Martin Center in North Carolina, has been doing fantastic work. I remember about a year and a half ago, using FOIA, he found documents about how Texas Tech was hiring biologists based on diversity statements. And the very next day after this Wall Street Journal op-ed by Saylor came out, the president of Texas Tech said, yeah, that's not appropriate. We're not going to be doing that anymore. So to mix metaphors, Scott, in a lot of these places, this is what gives me, I won't say hope, but less pessimism than otherwise, that in a lot of places, these are Potemkin villages guarded by paper tigers. So we just have to have enough of this sunlight, enough of these exogenous shocks, to force them to have these university leaders see, oh, I have to figure out the cost benefit structure a little bit differently. Placating the radical left is no longer as beneficial to me as it was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're pointing out, and just my own words on this are, first of all, I think journalism and investigative reporting was always the sort of check on truth, at least I thought so. And we had lost that for quite a while. And now we need people who are committed to that, because the media is so important in shining light on things, and it affects change. I think we need good, ethical young people to pursue this as a career. And then the second thing that you pointed out.
I'll just mention my colleague Chris Rufo at the Manhattan Institute is launched and expanded his Logos Fellowship to train investigative journalists. One of the first fellows there is Aaron Seberium, who's just a fantastic reporter for the Washington Free Beacon, working in this space,
yeah,
among
absolutely.
Others. But that's, you know, these alternative structures,
right.
Because you're not going to get people who do this kind of work from Columbia Journalism School.
Absolutely. And, I am a part of Global Liberty Institute, which, we have a young rising leaders program, and I'm proud to say that Aaron Seberium is one of our rising leaders, and he's done great, and we have several people like this. The second thing that you pointed out, I'll just finish with this, is that we do need people with courage to step up and realize that, individual speaking out is very important. It empowers other people to speak out. Most people are good people. Most people understand right from wrong. We can't be afraid to call it out. And I think, that's why, again, free speech, it's so important. Without that, we really can't even get the society we all really want in the end. But we'll finish with that, Ilya. I could talk to you all day, and maybe I'll have you back on.
During my Georgetown saga, the troubles, as some of my friends have taken to call it, I've realized the wisdom of, a lot of what Alexander Solzhenitsyn had to say, but live not by lies. Let the lie triumph, but not through me. And it might be easy for me to say, given that I'm sort of mid-career and I have a certain brand, and I've survived this cancellation attempt. I canceled them very publicly and all of that. But life's too short. I don't know what people are fearful of, and you can always find community. You can always find support. So courage is really important to have.
Couldn't agree more. And congratulations on not only surviving, but really pushing back and thriving. And when people see that, they're empowered. That's the value of it. We got to keep fighting. So thanks a lot, Ilya. Really a pleasure speaking. And I'll have you back on to talk more about particularly the Supreme Court.
Great.
Among
thanks.
Many things that will unfold.
Thanks, Scott. And my publicist would be mad at me if I didn't also promote my Substack, Shapiro's Gavel. I put stuff there that I wouldn't, publish in the Wall Street Journal or in my book, and sometimes personal stuff.
Excellent. I recommend everyone to go and look at your Substack, Shapiro's Gavel. Excellent. Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Ilya Shapiro of Manhattan Institute, watch his legal commentary in the news, in social media. Don't forget to subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.